Well, North American Rewilding Conference.
This is a time of year during this kind of slow winter introspection season that we get people together, individuals, groups, grassroots organizations, all people who are working to restore ecosystems and importantly, humans' place in them, and people who see humans as kind of woven in and connected part of nature, not separate from it, and talk about human history, what's happening in the environment right now, and kind of what all we can do about it together.
What does rewilding mean exactly?
Well, my favorite definition of it is living in community with your ecological place, kind of the idea of, like, regardless of where we come from, our ancestors come from, like, wherever we're living now, like, how can we be good stewards there? And how can we, like, reconnect to the wildness, the autonomy in ourselves and in our communities in a good way?
Well, the theme of this year's conference is subsistence and resistance. What can you tell me about that theme? Like, why was it chosen?
Subsistence as resistance has become our kind of perennial theme, and it is about trying to reclaim autonomy in our communities and see, you know, outside of the, you know, destructive forces of consumerism and capitalism, like, how can we work together to meet the needs of people and in our communities with all of the resources and skills and imagination that we have, like, right where we are.
What does that look like in the past, in years past, for this conference, this reclaiming of autonomy?
Well, we have had so many amazing speakers come over the years. And the cool thing about the conference is that we invite a lot of people who are thinking about these topics, and then the conference kind of creates itself. So it's not just about sitting and listening to experts speak. We do have speakers, and we do have... you know, usually some forums that kind of set the tone and get everybody on the same page around, like, being cultural ambassadors and, like, agreements. And we then have an open space, which is basically a conference that's created out of people's questions and curiosity. And it's a really cool technology where we kind of listen to some of the speakers that we've invited on different topics that could have to do with anything from, like, homesteading to wildlands restoration to, you know, seed saving, or some of the more, like, philosophical and theoretical parts of rewilding. And then we kind of have all of our questions on a board and get together in groups with people who are, you know, have the same curiosities and want to share about the same kind of things. And then the conference, like, creates itself, and it's pretty magical.
That's cool. I gotta imagine it's good for the planning side of things too, to not have to totally prescribe it.
Yeah, it's like kind of meets whatever people's needs that they come to the conference with. Hopefully they can, you know, create conditions to, like, get what they want out of it.
Well, with that, what are some of the activities and speakers that folks will find at this year's event?
So this year we have some amazing folks coming on Friday the 24th for the teaching day. Peter Michael Bauer, Rewild Portland instructor, is going to be talking and kicking things off. And then we have Mark Lakeman, who's the founder of City Repair, Lee from Shared Spaces Foundation. Andrew Sage is going to talk about reimagining the future of urban life, and Jennifer Rosemary Sarah is from Wapato Island Farms is going to be talking about connecting with our more than human kin and ancestral land tending and medicine making, and then finally Rain Crow from the Village Mystery School is going to be talking about animism, ancestral council way, which is kind of like transformational conflict resolution. So we're addressing, like, the, you know, ecology side of things, the human relation side of things, and then we can kind of, you know, ruminate on all of that overnight, and then Saturday it's open space. part of the conference. And then on Sunday, we're going to have land tending at three different locations where people can put some of the ideas into action and do some stewardship activities together.
I'm curious, with this sort of format, are there favorite conversations or things that have been sparked in years past in this conference that come to mind for you?
Yeah, there's been so many connections made over the years and so much inspiration. I am a parent, and I have sat in on some conversations around parenting and education and family and kind of rewilding the home that have been really awesome, had a lot of really great takeaways. And I also work in land stewardship planning, and I have met some amazing people who are doing land back work and have been connected with people who are doing seed ecology work and thinking about how do we, you know, tend land in the era of wildfires and, you know, water shortages and thinking about preparedness and on a community kind of neighborhood network. Those have all been really impactful for me, and I know other people have had like all kinds of different takeaways, and there's a lot of variety.
Mm-hmm. Who is this conference for? Who should come?
This conference, you know, over the past years, there have been folks from all walks of life, students, parents, farmers, gardeners, and tech folks who are, you know, feeling the stress of their jobs and are like, I want to reconnect with myself, I want to reconnect with nature. Really people from like lots of different fields of study and exploration and yeah, different paths. So it's a pretty diverse group. But I think one thing people have in common who are interested is that, you know, they are feeling like a disconnection from nature or self or community, and they want more connection and a feeling of a sense of wholeness in their life.
What do you hope that folks who do come and attend, what do you hope they get out of the event?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about that I think is going to be really impactful for people is our keynote speaker on Sunday afternoon, Rowan White, who's an Indigenous seed keeper, is going to be talking about her experience with food sovereignty. And I think it's going to be wonderful to hear from her. We really try to learn from Indigenous land stewards and traditionally ecological knowledge. And I think that she's going to wrap the conference up in a really good way. So I'm excited about that.
In doing this kind of work, do you encounter misconceptions that people might have about the idea of rewilding or why it's important?
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions. And Peter Michael Bauer has a podcast, the Rewilding Podcast, and I think the latest episode was about myths about rewilding. So people could check that out. But I think there's a lot of ideas that it might be about. There's a movement called conservation rewilding, or just like the environmental conservation movement, that thinks that land and nature is better without human intervention, and that we should like leave it alone, kind of fence it off and walk away. And that's a very, very different philosophy than the cultural rewilding movement that believes that humans aren't inherently bad in ecology. We have a place, but we need to find a balanced place, and looking at traditional cultures, we can understand better. And looking at earlier human history, the hunter and gatherer era, we can understand more about like what that balanced relationship looks like. What does reciprocity look like?
And yet urbanism still fits into that somewhere?
Yeah, we have to work with what we have, where we are at with our communities. So we can't all just go back to being hunter-gatherers now, but we can think about how to get more of our needs met in our communities and in more ecological ways, and be good stewards.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find out more about the event?
Rewilding.com is where all the details and registration are.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to mention?
I think that if there's folks out there who are feeling really anxious about the state of the world, or thinking about the environment and feeling worried and want to connect with other people who have you know, maybe a lot of the same feelings and want to connect and look for practical solutions and collaborative solutions to some of these really complex problems that we are up against. Like, this is a really good place, a really, like, inclusive and warm and, like, a safe place to, like, feel that anxiety and also feel hopeful.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Melissa Melko from Rewild Portland speaking with me about the upcoming annual North American Rewilding Conference. It'll be held January 24th, 25th, and 26th at Bridge Space Commons PDX. The address is 133 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information is online at rewilding.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. We're just 1 week away from the inauguration of President Donald Trump for the second time, and there's been no shortage of psychological analyses of the president-elect. But some would say that the main thing to know about him is that he's a capitalist, and they would say a particular kind of capitalist at that, a lumpen capitalist. Usually lumpen is a word that's associated with Karl Marx's concept of the lumpen proletariat, or those members of the working class who are really more like a criminal element, who lack awareness of their collective interest as an oppressed class. Some analysts see Trump as the capitalist equivalent of that. Samuel Farber is a retired professor at the Brooklyn College at the City University of New York who's written about Trump as a lumpen capitalist. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Lumpen capitalists. You know, people talk about the two wings of the ruling class, the ruling elite, and one takes power and then the other takes power. And according to some sources, it doesn't make much difference. So where would you place the lumpen capitalist here, and particularly in the case of Donald Trump? Does he represent one of the wings of the ruling class, or is this something entirely different?
I think, and maybe this brought in my article, and I bring our further today, perhaps even more. There's a number of capitalists in the energy section, for example. You can see the other capitalists are giving a tremendous amount of money to Trump, so there are certain sectors of the capitalist class that certainly support and certain individuals, for sure. But I don't think that the majority of the capitalist class supports it. We have seen, for example, that the overwhelming Kamala Harris and her campaign had much more money and spent a lot more money than Trump did. So clearly, in terms of being financed, that the Democrats were better financed and were also back in the previous elections in which one Trump won, the other one he lost, they were better. Hillary Clinton, for example, was better financed by Trump. So the question is, I think that some people on the left use a very mechanical approach to the relationship of the ruling class to certain politicians. And there are politicians that perhaps not so much in the United States, but I'll get that to you in a second, but politicians very often are outsider to the capitalist class, which doesn't mean that they do not defend the capitalist class interests and do not negotiate and coordinate with them. But they are not necessarily the candidates that the capitalist class would have preferred. And I believe Trump is one of them.
And have you heard also that the economy tends to do better under Democrats? And if that's true, do you think a lot of big business people recognize that? And so that causes them to support Democrats?
Well, I think that there might be something to that. But I think one thing that the capitalist, let's look at this specific case of Trump. One of the things that capitalism treasures, especially a highly developed form of capitalism, such as the American one, is predictability. Predictability and uniformity of rules. One thing that capitalists not particularly enjoy is arbitrariness. They're perfectly fine with arbitrariness vis-a-vis the working class and all the sectors of the population, but when it comes to the safety and security of their investment, they are not. specifically wanted to take chances, unless, this is the big unless there is such a profound crisis in society, falling apart, when the question of the security cannot be taken for granted for other reasons, that in that case, and this was the case of Germany in the late 20s, early 30s, they only saw a group that was definitely external to the capitalist class that were in office and ensuring their future because the situation was desperate. That is not the case in the United States. And the United States doesn't have the deep deflationary crisis that Weimar Germany was facing in 1928 during the World Recession, during the World Depression, which was the other side of the coin of the inflationary crisis that they experienced back in 22-23. So they went through an inflationary crisis, and then 5 years later with a deflationary crisis, which was part of the World Depression, and with a very powerful left, in some cases it's insurrectionary left, because the Communist Party was then in its ultra-left period throughout the world. So in that situation of lack of security, they are, of course, willing to support not just a Trump, but a Hitler.
What about the idea that Trump is a business failure? Does that make people at the higher levels distrust him, or is he considered in a way a success because it hasn't mattered to him that he's a failure? He manages to accumulate large amounts of money anyway and power.
Well, I think that Trump is a failure, and he isn't. As I pointed out in my article, he had a record number of bankruptcies. Bankruptcy was in a way his business.
And it hasn't seemed to matter.
Yeah, but now, since I wrote the article, you know, he developed something like Truth Social, you know, which has been successful in business terms, that is, it's the social media thing. And he's peddling Bibles, he's a hustler. So he has made money in other ways, not through hotels and real estate, but hucksterism, which fits very much, in my opinion, the characterization of Lumpen, because part of what characterizes the Lumpen sector of society, and I will get that in a second, is this kind of flightiness, this kind of instability, this kind of here today, there tomorrow, where it's a capitalist and other sector of society. So this case, Trump found other ways to hustle and make money, but he was never an important capitalist. That was a lot of make-believe that he has throughout his life, and very much influenced by Roy Kahn, who was his master. He was the guy who was responsible in great part for the execution of the Rosenberg, Roy Kahn. Roy Kahn was Trump's teacher, and therefore part of that Lumpen outlook on the world was make-believe, and make people make-believe to people that he was a super successful billionaire.
And what about the attitude of the Republican Party toward him? Do they care about that, the fact that he's a huckster?
Well, I don't think they really care. I think they are terrified of him. You know, right now we have a situation. We have senators from Alaska, two women from Alaska and from Maine, that do not like Trump at all and are making noises as to voting, if there is a chance to vote against this really useless and also candidates for office, like for attorney general, this guy from Florida, I think it is. But the threat he has over them that has been successful is, okay, you go ahead and vote against it, then the next election you come up, we're going to primary you. And primary you means we're going to find an opponent who, given by the support I have on the right wing, is going to be pitched. And so he has successfully done that several times. So he has them terrorized. Because I doubt very much that today, and that's why he wants a recent appointment so he doesn't have to get Senate approved. In fact, he's even opposed to an FBI review of this candidate. So today, I'm sure that he doesn't have a majority in the Senate. And that would be, and the same would be in January, because it would be like 53-47. That's not enough to assure particularly there are Republicans who would desert it. And at that point, by the way, John, there would be no marching around. The senator from West Virginia, because he not only will be a senator, and also the woman from Arizona, I don't remember his name, and then who also will not be a senator.
Oh, Christian Sinema, yeah.
Yeah, the two Democrats that were wavering on the line, those two are gone. So he knows very well that if he will get 47 Democrats, they will be not very difficult to find four people or Republicans that will vote against the certainly at least the case of Gates. How do you pronounce it? G-A-E-T-Z. I'm not even sure how to pronounce that word.
Yeah, I've heard it's Gates, yeah.
Yeah, who is that? By the way, it's another example. I don't know as much about him as I know about Trump, obviously. But a guy has all sorts of accusations. That report was about to be released in the House of Representatives about his abuse of women and all sorts of other stuff. And he resigned. So the House would no longer have jurisdiction over him, so to speak. So we're talking about a series of really incompetent, reactionary people who several positions in the government that are really disgraceful. Just think that to make Marco Rubio as the quote-unquote the left wing of the appointees, it's a joke.
And how about Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel?
Yeah, he's the only so-called establishment candidate that he has nominated. Why to the State Department? Because he's not afraid of the State Department. He already, when the previous time he occupied office, dramatically cut the budget of the State Department, which incidentally is one of the reasons why, and the massive cuts in the State Department, why it became more difficult for people to let their pass for the time. That's one of the results of that. So he's in a bind, but I do not at all trust even Democrats or Republicans to put up a fight.
So do you think he's going to be able to do what he says he's going to do in Ukraine and Gaza, just end those wars?
Very well. I wish and hope that he doesn't. Another area that I am intrigued about, because I don't have the sufficient knowledge, empirical, factual knowledge about it, is that he's making a lot of enemies in the FBI. And people in the FBI both have a lot of information on him that they could easily leak. They cannot do it as FBI, obviously, when they could easily leak it to the press. God knows what information they have from. So that's speculation. But clearly, aside from speculation, he's alienating them too. Because he said, I do not want any FBI review of the candidate I submit.
And you think he's going to go along with the Project 2025 recommendations and basically defang the regulatory agencies?
Trump is an opportunist. Trump is a totally unprincipled guy, including unprincipled guy right with terms. That is, after all, he wrote The Art of the Deal, right? He put against the wall, he would make deals then and there. And he's trying to push the whole of Project 2025, whatever it's called, is the problem. He will sideline it and choose among the proposals made in that project to see which one he's going to push forward. He has no obligation to that foundation to follow that thing to delay it, but he certainly can and will pick and choose among the proposals they make. And he's going to proceed. Remember that when he started back in 2017, his first period, in January 2017, the first thing he went for was for the undocumented worker. And the same thing is going to happen this time. But even there, he will have to be opportunistic if he's really serious about getting rid of all undocumented workers. He will have a serious economic crisis in the United States. More than half of farm workers in the United States are undocumented workers. More than half. Imagine what will happen with the orange crop in Florida, with all the crops that this magnificent state of California has, if all of a sudden they cannot count on more than half the labor force. I don't know if you and your people who listen to your program ever saw the movie A Day Without Mexicans. That was filmed, I don't know, 10 years ago. It is a comedy, but it's a very truthful comedy.
Well, and then you got the construction industry and the hospitality industry and the people who take care of people's children.
Construction services, hotels, restaurants, but agriculture is the strategically most important one. In the
Yeah, and I imagine there'll be a big pushback from various business lobby groups, wouldn't you think?
Right. So, but he too will be optimistic about it. He is, which is, you know, it would take a long time to support this, but it is also a characteristic of the Lumpenness, if you want to call it that, of Trump. There is a book that I would recommend to you and to your listeners, which is by the historian E.J. Hobsbawm, you know, who died about 10 years ago. British historian. Now, he wrote a book which I use in my courses very often, Primitive Rebel. And in that book, Primitive Rebel, he analyzes, historically analyzes the nature of the mafia, for example, in Italy, how it developed, and so on. And then he looks at so-called revolt or revolution, but they were not revolutions at all, in which the people in power used the Lumpen element in places like Italy, for example, Palermo, Sicily, Naples in Italy, to use those elements for reactionary purposes. And when I talk about Lumpen, I'm not talking about Lumpen in the loose sense of the word. I'm trying to follow, not because it's Marx, but because I believe it's right on this, what is the criminal element. The Lumpen doesn't mean the unemployed, doesn't mean the poor. That's slander. If people talk about this, that's the right wing that tries to demonize poor people and working people. That's not what Marx was using the term for. He was using the term against criminal elements who are for sale, politically speaking.
And the Nazis were able to recruit them as well, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the remarkable events in the history of Nazism was the night, what was called the Night of the Long Knives, which was in 1934, that Hitler was utilized to purge the so-called red fascists. And by that, the term was used to mean people who took seriously, including leaders like the Strasser brothers, for example, Captain Rom, R-O-H-M, who took seriously the so-called socialist ideology. Nazism is for national socialism, right?
Right.
They took seriously the socialism part of it, and were, in a sense, anti-capitalist, but also, as it happened, it was a very, had a very strong Bohemian element in the leadership of that group, including, for example, something that later became absolutely invisible to Nazism, you know, a lot of some of the leaders were gay. And Hitler used them to try to successfully take power. But once he was in power, at the first opportunity, which was just a year later, he wiped them out. He purged them, he killed them, and that was the end of the. And it was a looping element itself, many of these people, you know. So there's the classic example that of the Nazism using looping elements to gain power, and as soon as they had a chance, wipe them out. Because after all, Hitler was a jerk in his personal life.
Would you say there's any sort of analogy you could draw with groups like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, or there's something else entirely, you say?
Oh, absolutely. These are the sorts of people, and that's why I think that it's premature, in my opinion, it's premature, because things change, to talk about Trump as a fascist. Trump is a reactionary, but I think there are, unfortunately, there are current examples in Europe about governments, like, I think, in my opinion, the best example is the government of Hungary, which has formally retained the institutions of parliamentary democracy, but emptied it of content. So, Hungary today, I don't think anybody in their right mind would think, well, using the word in some position, not just, I mean, if you would use fascism as a swear word, I don't have a problem. You motherfucking fascist, you know, that kind of thing, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about term fascism in some kind of systematic, rigorous way. I don't think that the government of Hungary, certainly the government of Italy, which is led by an ex-fascist woman, or for them to come to power in France, the big mass right-wing movement there, I don't think that the word fascism as based on the 30s and 40s in Germany and the 20s to 40s in Italy is the kind of system that these type of groups are aiming to. I think they're aiming to an authoritarian, anti-democratic, reactionary thing. But not all anti-democratic, totalitarian movements and systems are fascists.
Would you think that it could be a what Bertram Gross called friendly fascism?
I may have even read it, but I don't think it was. And I think I did read it, but to be honest, I've read it such a long time, I don't remember it right now.
It's kind of like you have a corporatist society, but you know, you allow political dissent, but you make sure that they're suppressed, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't think that there will be anything friendly about Trump. What there will be is an unfriendly reactionary movement, which may develop into fascism, but I don't think that's what is likely to happen. But it's going to be a reaction and democratic that essentially will try to deprive the American system of whatever democratic content it still has. And I say democratic content it still has because, in my view, I'm sure many people would agree with it, if you compare the United States with other capitalist democracies, you know, France, England, Germany, etc., this is the least democratic of the capitalist democracies. Look at the kind of election we have with the Electoral College. You know, this is an archaic anti-democratic institution. That the Senate is elected a completely undemocratic way for 6 years, and Wyoming, which is the state with the least population in the United States, has the same Senate power than California, which is absurd.
And then they didn't even used to elect the Senate directly. It used to be selected.
So as far as the Senate is concerned, Wyoming has two, and California has two. California has millions and millions of people. Wyoming, I think, barely has a million people, or something like that. Maybe not even that.
Of course, you could say the same thing about Vermont, which is where Bernie Sanders got elected.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Bernie Sanders became a very popular guy in this country, but not because of the number of Vermonters who supported him. He became a popular figure in spite of that, not because of that.
That was retired Brooklyn College professor Samuel Farber speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about